Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, another week in the world of politics, and we're just a little over 100 days in the Trump administration, and the investigations and congressional hearings are underway for various allegations of wrongdoing. Let's get a sense of what those are all about, what it means going forward. Returning to the podcast, Professor Ben Epstein. He is a professor over at DePaul University, where he teaches all sorts of related courses in political science, and he's just an amazing guy who knows all this stuff. And Ben, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's great to be here.
So this past week, of course, we had Sally Yates testify before a congressional committee. Let me just ask you your response, assuming you are familiar with what she said. Did it accomplish anything?
You know, I think that it was, it was newsworthy for sure. I think that it definitely did a couple of things. It kept this Russia probe front and center in the news. I think that her positions seem to be solidified in the public forum for the first time, and I think that was really notable. There are some questions about how many brand new things happened, but there's no question that under some serious questions, especially from Republican senators, that she held her own extremely well and made it very clear that what her concerns were had a lot of validity, and ultimately, I think, continued a lot of the questions, or maybe brought up a couple new questions about why Michael Flynn was kept on for as long as he was, and other concerns. But there were some possibilities, especially from James Clapper, that there might be some other investigations that may be going on that might have been new news. But I think that remains to be seen at this point.
You know, one of the things you said that was interesting, you referred to what the Republican senators did in question, which, of course, highlights the fact, was this a partisan hearing? Mm-hmm. There's a sense that I have, that I just believe, like, it's the right sense of this, which is when you're exploring the possibility and what happened with regard to Russia's interference with our election, is there a sense that this really shouldn't be a partisan issue? And yet, as you watch those hearings, it seemed as though the Democrats were talking all about Mike Flynn and trying to, you know, work its way up to the White House on those issues. And you're right, Republicans sort of focused in on the leaks and you didn't follow your duties and all of that. It sounded pretty partisan to me in a discussion that shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I think it's hard to find anything coming out of Congress in particular that's not partisan these days. And this is, I would agree with you completely. This is one thing that should absolutely not be partisan. And I think that we should publicly acknowledge and thank those people that seem to be really focusing on following through with these investigations. I think that notably, Lindsey Graham has pretty consistently from the Republican side talked about how this needs to be. This is a valid, a valid line of question, and should be supported generally. But those examples are few and far between, and especially as Republicans hold the majority in both houses of Congress, that and hold leadership positions on all these subcommittees, that matters.
Yeah, and it's just very frustrating. I mean, I'd like to think I would say the same thing if it was a Democratic president. If you have
Absolutely.
These kind of allegations and you have this kind of interference, and if there was collusion, which nothing in these hearings suggested that there was yesterday, but
right.
both sides should want to get to the bottom of it.
Right, right. No, I mean, this is a very legitimate and very serious situation. There's no question that there was involvement from Russia in the election. There's no question that Mike Flynn had relationships that were unreasonable and would at least put his position in question. And so I think anyone objectively looking at that would understand that that these are questions that we need to ultimately answer and do a thorough and hopefully a bipartisan job of really trying to get to the bottom of this.
I do want to toss in, and I talked about this on our WGN Morning News, which is Sally Yates is a acting attorney general, but a U.S. attorney. You know, I train those people. I work with those folks, and there's good and bad in everything. But I will say one thing, other than the political appointees, U.S. attorneys are not partisan people. They have a job to do. They'll prosecute you no matter what party you're in.
Right.
If anything, that may do that to a fault, which is sometimes they're not able to see the forest for the trees because they are going after the prosecution. And Sally Yates herself was a Bush appointee. So she's appointed. She served under Republican presidents, Democratic presidents. And to try and turn her into a partisan hack, which seemed to be the effort certainly of Senator Ted Cruz, it's almost an insult to the judicial system.
Yes,
and the justice system, I should say.
Yep, I would agree completely. I think that your expertise in this particular area far exceeds mine, but I would absolutely agree. I mean, these are people that are trained and have absolutely the goal of maintaining and enforcing justice and the laws. I mean, this is not a partisan issue, and in Sally Yates' case, you're exactly right. She served under different administrations and has been widely praised and widely and widely supported by people on both sides of the aisle, really up until this last couple months when her position and her actions have been seen through partisan lenses pretty clearly.
And here where the White House is alerted to the concerns about Mike Flynn and that he was truly a security risk to the security of this nation in one of the top spots. And she's the one that gets fired initially.
Right.
Eventually, follows her out the door. And that's only because of a Washington Post story.
Well, yes. I mean, when she was let go, she was let go because she refused to enforce the immigration and refugee ban. And obviously, I think that her action there, she knew that was going to happen. That action was seen in some ways as being connected to her opposition to Michael Flynn, and in some cases sort of came out later that her opposition to and warning about Michael Flynn had been something that she voiced. I'm trying to think about the sequence of events, but I think that she really became national news when she was fired, and then later I think it became much more widely known that she was had been a part of this understandable concern about Michael Flynn from an early point.
That's absolutely true. She was not in the news with regard to this issue until later. But let's go back to the politics of all this.
Sure.
When Sally Yates alerted the general counsel of the White House to what was going on, and there had to be two meetings towards that end, 18 days passed before the White House did anything. Sean Spicer in a press conference referring to essentially what she was doing was giving the White House a heads up on this issue. And even when it came out to light earlier in the week that President Obama had told then President-elect Trump, not to bring Flynn on, and who knows specifically what President Obama said, but I imagine he was fairly candid about the issues. All of that stuff, just all of a sudden, this was Obama's fault. He's the one that gave him a security clearance. He's the one that should have vetted him and all that. What is there, politically speaking? Wouldn't the Trump administration look a lot better if they just basically said, we messed this up, we fired him? I mean, basically take the high road on this instead of always pushing the blame. It's never us. It's never us.
Short answer is yes. I mean, but that's not Donald Trump's MO, and it's not the strategy of his administration. I've never seen anyone in public life that is so adamantly opposed to admitting any wrongdoing, ever backtracking, ever taking responsibility for something that went wrong to an absolute fault. And what I've said before is that it has served him extraordinarily well. I think that his relatively brief and extremely successful political career suggests to him and to his administration that admitting that they were wrong is not something that they've had to do in the past. And I don't and it does not seem that they are interested in doing that moving forward. Michael Flynn, there were major red flags from a very early stage. There were warnings from multiple people that had absolute knowledge of why they should be concerned, including former President Obama. And these were not heeded, and he was fired. The opportunity to right after that say we made a mistake, and a firing of someone in that prominent position that early on in the administration suggests that it was a poor decision. But to admit that or to even talk about Michael Flynn at this point seems to be something that the current administration is avoiding. They're talking about other people and media and various other agents that have they think have done the real wrong here.
And, of course, what's going to be interesting, if indeed Michael Flynn ever does testify, and if he is given immunity, once again, a point I made on our WGN News was that the only reason to grant Flynn immunity is for him to point to other people, and they're not concerned about him pointing downward. They're concerned about who he would point to upwards in that process.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, who knows exactly what he may or may not say if that ever happens. But I believe I'll paraphrase, but his attorney basically said he has quite a story to tell. They're trying to build up Michael Flynn's case of, and it very well may be true that he has a lot of information. But also it would be, he's looking for immunity early on, which does not bode well for him, but does suggest that maybe he knows things, maybe he doesn't. Time will tell.
All right, exactly. I'm going to bridge a little bit to another topic in this way. As you looked at polls in recent weeks, of course, Trump supporters, man, they stay with him no matter what. Yeah. 96% of people say they'd vote for him again tomorrow. So nothing seems to sway them. But then we did have this health care vote, which passed the House, for which there was an attaboy, slap yourself on your back, grab a beer party over at the White House. Two pieces to this discussion. Number one, what happens to that plan, which I think is it's down the drain. But number two, if there is a health care plan that passes that ultimately removes health care from a lot of Americans, millions of Americans, one way or another, is that what turns the polls? Do people then, is that what it takes to turn on President Trump? Or do they not pay, that he's not the one that will ever pay a price because he's promising everybody we're going to take care of everything. It'll be those congressmen who pay the price.
Yeah, there's a lot there. But I think that I think your first question was really about what happens to that House bill. And despite all of the high-fiving and beer drinking and celebratory nature in the Rose Garden last week, the reality is that what happened in the House or what was passed by the House, it sounds like the Senate is almost entirely scrapping that. They're going to be starting either entirely fresh or they're going to be dramatically revising that. There's no way that that House bill passes the Senate as is. And no matter what happens in the Senate with a dramatically redefined new bill, if it does pass the Senate, and I think that's a very big if at this point, if it does, it's going to be very different from the House bill. It will need to go back to the House, and the House and Senate GOP is a long way away from actually getting this through. And in the meantime, they're going to be getting a CBO score of this. They're going to have much more information about it. The public support for the previous bill was about 17%. The overall popularity of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare has never been higher. Most have it somewhere between 50% and 55%.
I just want to stop you right there. Do you think that's because before the hatred towards that act was really a sign of just dislike for President Obama, but now that things got real with regard to health care, people woke up and basically said, now what is this thing doing for me?
Yeah, I think that part of it is an anti-Obama piece. Part of it is the framing, right? That so many people did not know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act were the same thing. They talk about now there's these great cases of Kentucky that is trying to really run away from the Affordable Care Act. But in Kentucky, they used Obamacare, but they called it Connect, K-Y something, Connect.
And Governor Steve Beshear a little credit, former yes. governor of Kentucky.
Brilliant move, totally distanced them from Obamacare, but just repackaged it and sold it to a huge number of people that needed it, that otherwise couldn't afford health insurance, and largely voted for Donald Trump. So the idea that this is going to disproportionately hurt poorer, sicker, older Americans, this is a huge, huge change, not only the economy, all right, one-fifth of the economy, but ultimately to the livelihoods of millions and millions of people. And I think that there were pieces of the Affordable Care Act that were always fairly popular, and the threat of taking those away only makes them more popular.
You know, we're not that far away from a first special election coming up, Georgia 6, where, of course, John Ossoff, the Democrat, you know, didn't pull it off, and he got in 50 plus 1% of the votes last time around. There'd be no runoff. There is a runoff, and all predictions pretty much are it is a safe Republican district. But do you think this health care mess is something that in both that special election and others coming up? Because, I mean, everything else is 2018, a lot to happen before that. But that election in June, what do you think? Is there an impact on that right now, or is that in people's the forefront of their minds?
I think it if it's not, it absolutely should be, that anyone who is anyone in the House that voted, I mean, everyone in the House that voted for this, whether this becomes law or not, is going to be used in their re-election bids in 2018, and for a few cases, there are going to be special elections before that. There's no question that this is going to impact 2018. I think that, and even elections before that, there was recently a really, it's been getting some buzz, but an ad from, I believe, a gubernatorial candidate in Virginia who is standing in front of an ambulance being crushed and essentially showing what this Democratic candidate is suggesting Republicans are doing to their health care and to ultimately the access that people have to doctors. And this could be a model that other people follow, but ultimately there is no question that taking away or the effort to potentially remove or reorganize how so many people get health insurance and the subsidies that are involved in that, it would be dramatic, and it would be, I don't know how that is spun politically to the Republicans' advantage outside of following up on a constant promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. If you repeal and replace Obamacare, that might be a good thing politically, but if you repeal and replace it with something that is far worse for more Americans, then that brief win turns into a big loss.
And that's one of the reasons the Senate basically said, we're not paying any attention to the House bill. We're doing our own thing. And that means that any kind of action is many, many months away, if ever at all.
We'll be able to watch this for a while. Yeah.
Don't you know? And I hope you'll come back and talk to me about it. Professor Ben Epstein.
I'd love to.
DePaul University, always a pleasure talking to you, my friend. And we'll see you again on Politics Tonight and on the podcast. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
I could have danced all night. I could have danced.
Of course, you're very familiar with that very famous song, very famous music, a song called I Could Have Danced All Night from My Fair Lady. Just one of those things that you know it so well, sometimes you forget it's actually from a Broadway musical. But My Fair Lady, which, God, it was around since the early 60s, and it is back. It is at the Lyric Opera House, and you don't want to miss it. It's going to be playing until May 21st. Although if you watch WGN, you've seen some of the cast members on our shows and on radio, and you know they've been making appearances. But one of the things that has always struck me about My Fair Lady is just the wonderful dialects that people have to learn in order to do that, and for that matter, other shows. So I wanted to track down the person who trains those people to master the dialects, because I'm thinking we might get a free lesson out of this for all of us and be able to do a dialect. So joining me now, Christina Dare. She is a professor at the Chicago College of Performing Arts at Roosevelt University. She actually began her career as an actor, but she, working with renowned voice artists, she has become a master teacher of techniques, working with names known to so many of you. I know Keanu Reeves, Matthew Modine, Marlo Thomas, Tom Hardy, but also Chicago great Deanna Dunnigan, and so many, and has worked at so many venues. But she got everybody all prepared to do the dialects at My Fair Lady. Christine, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Well, I didn't hear a dialect when you just said that.
Well, actually, I'm speaking general American.
Oh, so there is such a, you know, I'm in broadcasting, and so there is this, we always hear about sort of newscasters have to speak this Midwestern American dialect. Is there truth to that?
Well, I think there was in the past, but I think now in this country and in the UK, you hear a wide variety of accents. But there is something that actually I teach my students called General American. When I went to school, we used to call it Standard American. But whose standard is the big question?
Right.
So General American is is the term we use now. But it's American without any kind of regional signifier.
So we can't tell where you're from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
How do you, you know, of course, My Fair Lady, very strong Cockney accent. It is Cockney,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we get kind of the proper English. That's what My Fair Lady is all about. If people don't know the Pygmalion story, we have Professor Henry Higgins who takes Eliza Doolittle, and he takes her from this very, how would you describe it? Just very unsophisticated Cockney dialect and turns her into a very refined British-type speaking lady. And just sort of curious, how the simple question. How easy is it to teach? Because you work with adults. You've worked with the kids in Mary Poppins. How easy is it to teach this stuff?
Well, it's really different depending on the actor. So some actors are, you know, really have a good ear. They can mimic. They can.
What about Keanu Reeves? Was he quick with this?
No, well, I thank God I didn't have to teach him an accent.
you just had to teach him to talk.
No, I just worked with his voice. So I think he's not been so successful.
This is good. I didn't think about getting dirt from you about these people. I like this idea. Matthew Modine, was he? He must have been a toughie.
Well. And again, actually, I didn't work with an accent. I helped him with text.
He was over at the Goodman. That was probably for his show at the Goodman. Yeah. Okay.
Finishing the picture. Yeah.
So back to learning the dialects. I'm sorry, I'm wandering to all these wonderful things. So how easy? I mean, if you were going to teach me, first of all, can you teach any dialect? Do you have a range that certain ones you do and others you don't?
Well, I'm a dialect nerd, so I love doing research. So I think, you know, given enough time, I could teach anything. So I've gotten some really kind of bizarre requests in the past, you know, things that I wasn't familiar with. But then I do my research, and I think the key to teaching it is to have a lot of different ways in. So some actors, they can listen to something and they get it. Other people have to really see, you know, have to work from a video. Like when I was working with Tom Hardy at the Goodman, he really wasn't interested in, you know, seeing anything written, anything really recorded, but we had to find videos because he wanted to see the way it looked.
But that of course is a reflection of the fact that people learn in different ways. There are visual learners, right?
Exactly, and you know, kinesthetic learners, somebody like that. You know, it's all about how it feels in the mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. Yeah.
So, and by the way, let me verify this with you, too. In My Fair Lady, Henry Higgins is sort of a dialect expert. And, I mean, in the show, he's able to hear somebody talk, and basically, as he says, he can put them within, like, two blocks from where they live. Now, of course, it's a funny thing in the show, but let me ask you, you're the expert. How accurate can you be in listening to, if I played a dialect for you, how accurate can you be in terms of, let me tell you where that's from?
Oh, I know some people could just do kind of party games with that. I really can't.
But I mean, is Henry Higgins, is what he said potentially truthful, that you can literally take it to a particular area of the city?
Well, I guess that's true. I mean, certainly think of Chicago, think of the different neighborhoods, and so somebody who is really tuned in to, you know, the specifics of all of that, I imagine you could.
Especially in this city. Okay, so
Now
I wanted to, before I get my free lesson, I want to demonstrate a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, but I need you to help me here because I've got a little clip of our Eliza Doolittle after she's become the sophisticated British, but I don't have a clip of her doing that Cockney up front. So can you do, we're going to hear a little Rain in Spain, but can you do a little bit of, how does Eliza sound? How did you teach her to sound when we first meet her in My Fair Lady in a Cockney way?
Well, the Cockney, it's, I guess that what I like to start with is what I call the oral posture.
Okay.
So with Cockney, the jaw is really tight. The lips are kind of flat and thin. And you have to have your cheeks up. So it's kind of, and everything's kind of spread.
I'm trying it as we say this. Hello, Governor. How was that? Hello,
Hello.
Governor.
Hello. So it's just, it's there's not much space in the mouth. So everything's kind of squished. The soft palate is low. And I think the key to it is the cheeks. The cheeks.
Keeping them up.
Be really cheeky.
Now, I don't know if you, do you know, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but like, can you sort of say the Rain in Spain, say, you know, give us that line in a Cockney way, and then we're going to see how she's worked through it.
Let's see. The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
So it's those A's, right?
Yeah, the A's almost go to it like an I. The rain in Spain stays mainly on the plane.
And then Henry Higgins works with her, and then one day, late at night, she sort of just says it, and here's how eventually it sounds.
Right.
By George, he's got it! By George, he's got it! Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plane.
And where's that soggy plane?
So there it is. It's beautiful. Great. Now, let me ask you, are we hearing natural dialects there, or is there still a dialect you're having to teach to get that really nice-sounding phrasing?
Well, I was really blessed with the lyrics casting in this production because most of the leads, they cast British actors.
I know. That's what I'm wondering. So is that their actual – is that the way they sound?
Pretty much. I mean, I think, you know, this play was originally produced in 1913 for the first time.
That was as Pygmalion, not the musical, the Pygmalion.
Oh, right. Yes, 1960. Yes, Pygmalion. So some of the sounds in this production are archaic. So you wouldn't. Yeah, there were some sounds like with Richard E. Grant.
Who plays Henry Higgins.
Yes. I mean, he has, he's a Brit, so he has a fabulous natural accent. But there are certain things that he's doing that you wouldn't hear today in London.
Ah, and that you had to train him to do.
No. I mean, he's actually married to a very famous dialect teacher coach.
Oh, wow.
In London.
We don't need you, Christine. I'm bringing my wife in.
That's right. I mean, she's like the queen of dialects, Joan Washington.
Oh, I love
her
it.
Name. But no, I mean, mostly with most of the leads, what I mainly worked with them on in the upper class stuff was clarity so that a Chicago audience could understand them.
Yeah. Now there, that one's a fairly easy one where we have that sort of, you know, almost very basic Cockney that becomes the very beautiful British sound. Then there's another example where we have the father of Eliza. He has a different dialect from what we hear in the show, and he doesn't change. He always stays the way he is. Let's take a moment and listen to the dialect that we hear in Get Me to the Church on Time.
Okay.
I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Pull out the trumpets, but don't lose the compass. And get me to the church, get me to the church. For God's sake, get me to the church.
So, you know, as I listened to it, even as I watched My Fair Lady, you know, for God's sake, just the way things are said, is there a certain part of London or of England we're going to hear that particular kind of dialect?
Well, I think, again, I mean, he's basically Cockney. It's just much broader than Eliza's. So, also he's singing, which...
Oh, is there a difference in getting somebody to speak versus sing with that dialect?
It is a little bit different. I mean, as a coach, I worked real closely with the musical directors, with David Chase, the conductor, and Michael Black, the chorus master, so that the dialogue and the singing, the sounds were consistent. But there, especially some of the Cockney song sounds, are really difficult to sing.
Now, what about that actor? Is he British?
No, Donald. Actually, he's Scottish, but he lives in Wales, and he's playing a Cockney.
now, just so we can understand. So, you pick a phrase, rain in Spain, whatever. But can you speak? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you do it sort of as he might say it as a Scot, and then how we might hear it as a Cockney? Just hear that distinction.
Well, Scots is, you know, it's let's. Oh boy, well.
Didn't know I was going to quiz you, did you?
everything is great. So the Scots, it's very kind of earthy.
And the rolling, the rolling of the R.
Yeah, the rolling, yeah, the great, great. And, you know, I, down, a brigadoon.
Is it easier to work? So you have a Scot who you have to teach Cockney. You get Americans that you have to teach Brit. Is there somebody who's easier to work with than others? In other words, it's easier to start with an American dialect and take them somewhere? Or does none of that matter?
I don't think it matters, really. I find children are really really good at this. And
you worked with the kids of children. Mary Poppins, including
one
of the little Michael Banks, played on Many Nights by Casey Lyons, who's a young man that I know, 11 years old, and that guy's got the accent down.
Yeah. Well, they're good mimics, I think, and I worked on both national tours of Mary Poppins, too, so I've worked with a lot of kids. And
they're more so kids are easy to work because you've worked with Mary and Mary Poppins. Are kids easier to work with than adults?
Well, no, not necessarily. But I think that they're not as afraid, and it's more like play for them. And so they can pick it up easier, I think, a lot of times.
Is there is there any accent or dialect that you find difficult to work with? Like, oh, don't make me teach somebody that.
Let's see.
I mean, Russian, or I don't know. Just or is there nothing really that's much of a challenge?
I think I could. I mean, I think I could probably. I mean, with enough time and research and everything, I think I could. I think I could teach almost anything.
Wow. This is fun. Because I love language. I love learning language, but just even getting there. Because you know what? It's one thing to speak French, but when somebody goes, parlez-vous français, it's kind of like not the point. Don't learn French if that's the way you're going to say it.
Right.
Say it right. This is fabulous, Christy. This is great fun. So I'm going to have one more challenge for you, which, of course, is to just say goodbye to us. Let's pick a fun dialect. Since I said... Well, I said French or Italian. I'll go to Europe. I'm going to make this easy. Brent, what's your favorite dialect to do?
My favorite dialect. Well,
I'm going to assign you one.
I do like Scots.
All right. But we did Scots. You don't get to do that again. I say French. I love speaking French. Vous parlez français, oui? So let's do that in French. But I do want to remind people that My Fair Lady, I get so caught up in this, is playing at the Lyric Opera until May 21st through May 21st. LyricOpera.org is where you can get the tickets. And I got to tell you, as I'm sure you know, just watching My Fair Lady at the Lyric Opera, I mean, with all due respect to the wonderful theaters we have in the city, there is no experience like sitting at the Lyric and looking up at that incredible stage and the incredible costumes. I described it in my review comment that they use in the ads is regal and grand and majestic, which I really found this production to be. I hope you agree.
Yes, I do.
So you can tell me that you agree in a French accent. Go ahead.
Oui.
You don't have to speak French.
But I have to have like a trigger. So I needed like a trigger.
Did you enjoy watching My Fair Lady?
Yes. I enjoyed it very much.
I love it. You sound like a French person searching for their English.
Yes. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup to you. Christina Dare, professor at the Chicago College of Performing Arts at Roosevelt University. Thanks for letting me have fun with this.
Okay. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. That's My Fair Lady at the Lyric Opera through May 21st, lyricopera.org. Appreciate it. Thank you. Merci beaucoup. I will talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.